first time I saw Jimmy Trumbull, he was passed out in his Cadillac behind the Fat Cat Bar and Grill in Norwich. It was the summer of 1988. My rent was higher than Oil Can Boy's ERA, and my prospects were lower than Rich Gedman's batting average. That year, I was living in a Gale's Ferry double-wide on Long Cove Avenue. In the summer afternoons, the lithium fumes from Norwich would hit the Viagra haze drifting in from Groton. The sunsets turned as blue as an old New London stripper. Back in those days, I had a little office on Railroad Street in Norwich. Mickey Minor, P.I., acquire the proof, discover the truth. The next afternoon, I was sitting there with my feet on the desk, thinking about going out for a frappe or a cabinet. And what was the difference? And then, we're closed.
You, Mickey Minor.
That's what it says on the door.
Your slogan doesn't rhyme.
Yeah? What rhymes with passed out in the caddy?
Last out is a patty. What's your point?
The last time I saw you, it looked like you were making the Gansett factory work overtime.
I'm drawing a blank.
Last night.
Last night, I played bingo at the Pequot Hall.
You take their wampum?
I do okay.
You got a job, Skippy?
I work over at Thermos. You know, it keeps hot things hot and cold things cold.
How does it know which to do?
I don't follow you.
You never will. Okay, I'll take your case, but I get $100 a day plus expenses.
I don't have a case. I'm looking for the bathroom.
Down the hall, but it's wicked filthy. He'll be back. They all come back. The misery washes down the Thames like a lost shad. But for now, it was just me and the Rose of New England. By any other name, she would smell better. But that's another story for another day. Right now, I got a date with some belly clams. And now, he's still waiting for Benedict Arnold to pay his legal bill. Colin McEnroe.
I helped the guy out, and what did I get for it? All right, so you just heard our imagination of what sort of southeastern Connecticut noir would sound, but we don't really have to imagine it. We have the writers here who do it. Not always noir, but always southeastern Connecticut. You know, I started to think about this years ago when reading I Know This Much Is True by Wally Lamb, one of our guests here today, and his protagonist, Dominic Birdsey, and I was thinking, boy, I really know this guy. Like, you know, I know this guy. He's not me exactly, but I know him. I understand sort of the way he thinks and what his points of reference are. I recognize all this. And I thought, it really is sort of, you know, I mean, it really is just the way Southern California is for Raymond Chandler. This is a writing about a place where these characters have things, have ways in which the place that they're from is evoked. And it's a very – then you start thinking about it and you think it's a really unusual place. Dude, there's a reason why writers would be attracted to it. In Wally's case, it may have been less volitional. I mean, he's from there. One of our other guests, Jon Manuel Andriotte, came back there, and Stephen Dobbins, novelist, I think, was drawn there by some of the things that we're going to talk about there today. Let me tell you a little bit more about all of them. Wally Lamb, you probably know. First of all, he's on our show a lot. He's a friend of the show. His novels do include I Know This Much Is True, and She's Come Undone, and We Are Water. His sixth novel, I'll Take You There, will be published electronically by Meta Books in 2016. And Jon Manuel Andriotte is a reporter and author of Victory Deferred, Wilhelmina Goes Wandering, and most recently, Tough Love, A Washington Reporter Finds Resilience, Ruin and Zombies in His Other Connecticut Hometown, and of course being Norwich. They're both in studio with me. Joining us by phone is Stephen Dobbins. He's a poet of 13 volumes of poetry, including Winter's Journey and Velocities, with a new volume out next fall. And he's here, although he's written many novels, he's here in particular to talk about Is Fat Bob Dead Yet? Boy, is there ever a that's a just, you know, perfect title for a new London novel, and that's what it is. He's going to be at the Public Library in New London on Saturday, November 7th at 1 o'clock to talk about that book. You probably could get it signed. If you haven't seen the cover yet, you'll never forget the cover. I promise you that. So they're all here. We're going to have this conversation. We're live on the air in the afternoon. If you've got something to weigh in with, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. So, Wally, I'll start with you. You know, Three Rivers is the town where you've set so much of your fiction. It's pretty identifiably Norwich. We even know what Three Rivers they are. But what is this place? What, when you think about this place, what are its defining characteristics? What gives it its kind of thrust in your fiction?
Well, I think unlike, say, the Gold Coast of Connecticut, we're more more liverwurst than pate, and you know, we're a little feistier. We are perhaps a little bit less focused on the material things. I think we're probably more influenced by Boston than New York, and so you know, we drop our R's and You know, we tend to root for the Red Sox, although there are a number of Yankee fans.
But it really is. I mean, it's barely volitional. I mean, you really do have to root for the Red Sox. I mean, well, you're going to be an outlier if you root for the Yankees. Right?
Yeah. Or in the present state, you root for the Mets. But, you know, that's just this year.
John, you know, there's a way in which this area – well, we should first of all let you tell a little bit of your story. So you are from there. You moved away. You came back. There probably aren't that many returning pilgrims who come back to Norwich. What brought you back there?
Well, I moved back to Norwich in 2007 after living in Washington, D.C. for almost 22 years and working there as a journalist, building my career. And a personal situation in 2005 kind of opened my eyes to my life going forward. And I asked myself, what do I want? What do I want? I thought it might be nice to live in a smaller town. I was kind of tired of D.C. And suddenly Norwich presented itself after lunch with the editor of the newspaper there. And it was all I could think about after our luncheon on the way back to D.C. is what would it be like to live there now as the man that I became all these years later? And it was a very appealing picture. So it really is the place itself and all that it symbolizes. It's New England heritage. My family's roots there. 5 generations of my family have lived there. And I describe Norwich as an American melting pot in a saucepan size. it's an incredibly interesting, diverse city for a city of 40,000 people.
I feel also as though that whole area, the whole southeastern Connecticut area that you guys all write about, it seems a little less touched by modernity than every. I mean, everywhere you go these days, there's this kind of polypeptide sequence of CVS and Boston Market and Starbucks and you know, I don't know, and Cumberland Farms, right? And it's not as though you don't have that in eastern Connecticut, although in Sterling or something, you probably don't. But so you have like Stocks and Pillories and a butter churn or something. But I just say that to provoke the people from Sterling. But there's sort of a way in which even if you've got all that stuff, underlying it is something a little bit more rigorous that's fighting back in a way that like West Hartford or wherever. We've just given up. You know, I mean, whatever. You know, we're heterogenized exactly the way everybody else is. I feel like there's a couple of things going on, but there's a way in which that area is fighting back a little bit or refusing to accept it. I mean, does that make sense to you?
Yeah. You know, I think part of it has to do with the Norwich Free Academy, which is atypical and not like any other high school in the country. It's got its own museum. Mm. And because it's the only school in town, secondary school, then, you know, it has a lot of very loyal alums. And so, you know, we're instead of having A's and B's and C's, NFA has 5s and 4s and 3s and 2s and 1s. And juniors are third year. Freshmen are greasies. And sophomores are called lowers and so forth. So that right there is a kind of a typical example of how we're different.
Well, I think, John Manuel Andriotte, another way that I think it's different there is, I mean, you know, they talk about how in the Middle East, people talk about the Crusades like it happened yesterday. And I think in eastern Connecticut, things like the American Revolution and the life of Native Americans, when Native Americans were really alive there, to me, that seems much more alive than it is sort of west of the river.
Absolutely. I think that east of the river and southeastern Connecticut and Norwich in particular is very much connected to its New England heritage. And now in the fall, you know, when New Englanders are prone to saying you can take a New Englander out of New England, but you can't take New England out of that person. And it's no more true than in the fall when New England is at its most spectacular. And in eastern Connecticut, it really is incredibly beautiful. Charming country drives, steepled white churches, really a sense of belonging to a place and a heritage is very powerful there.
Let's add Stephen Dobbins to this conversation. Your new novel, Stephen Dobbins, is Fat Bob Dead Yet? I mean, it begins with kind of a quick bird's eye tour around New London. And it's clear that this isn't an arbitrarily chosen city, that this novel is going to be at least partly about a place. So what drew you to that place? Why New London? Why not someplace else?
I like the contradictions of it, that it was a town full of beautiful buildings and a town full of very ugly buildings, a town full of wealthy people and a town full of extremely poor people. They're often talking about renovation. We're going to build up Bank Street again. Yet the trains go through right very close to Bank Street, blowing about 50 of them a day, blowing their horns over and over and over. I mean, nobody could live there unless you had very big padded windows. And I like that. I live in Westerly, which is just up the road, about 10, 15 miles.
So you probably do call it a cabinet instead of a frap.
I don't know what I call it. I have to watch my weight, man.
All right. So, I feel like in this novel, Stephen, you're going for some kind of combination of noir and gothic, right? I mean, there's just there's got to be a way in which that the style of New London plays into that for you, that it is a place where strange things can happen and maybe happen kind of graphically. Does that sound reasonable?
Mm-hmm.
Say a little bit more about that. I mean, say, once again, what did you see there?
I like the water. I like the contradictions. I like the sense of promise and the sense of failure all at the same time. And I thought I could put a book there that would also have contradictions, also have people who are very different from other. I mean, most of the characters in the book have several names, birth name perhaps, and their real name, or their assumed name, or the name that the FBI gave them, or and so it goes back and forth with who are these people. One of the characters uses the word tridiculous.
Yeah, I was going to come to tridiculous, yeah. What does that mean?
It combines tragedy and the ridiculous. And the main symbol of it would be slipping on a banana. The person flies into the air, everyone laughs, and then he falls on his back, breaks it.
Yeah.
There are many things like that. And the characters represent that in many ways. So, and the person who talks about or invents the word tridiculous is a scammer, really, making cold calls to people in the area for such groups as free beagles from nicotine addiction and Prom Queens Anonymous, and even one that he keeps coming back to, although it doesn't get him much money, Orphans from Outer Space.
Well, so that's a perfect segue for me. I am going to do the unforgivable and quote myself, but in 2002, the New York Times asked me to go and write about Foxwoods, and I sort of described what you see, as you're kind of driving down and those spires come up and how weird and Oz-like Foxwood looks dropped in the middle of all this. But I wrote, but then this is Eastern Connecticut, where I've been assured by more than one apparently sober person that there's a space-time vortex in the vicinity of Sterling, that Satanists conjure up demons in the Devil's Hop Yard in East Haddam, and that there is a giant ancient stone clown head somewhere out in the woods. The state archaeologist has found evidence of early Americans disturbing graves in southeastern Connecticut because they feared vampires were living in them. That's actually true. Nick Bellantonia has discovered that. So, Wally, that's not so much there in your fiction. Your fiction is, I think, about normal people struggling with abnormal challenges, but I think lurking in the background is this sense, once again, we're not in Litchfield,
Right. And with this new book that I'm just finishing up now, it does come out of the shadows. I never imagined that I would be telling a sort of ghost story. But in I'll Take You There, which, Stephen, you might be interested in, has a new London setting and specifically the Old Guard Theater.
Right.
I had a premiere for a movie that was made from one of my earlier novels at the Guard Theater, and I was told there by the managers that there had been ghost sightings there. And so I took that and ran with it. And so I've got, you know, Eastern Connecticut meets, paranormal Eastern Connecticut.
And John Manuel Andriot, you know, as we go a circle outside of Norwich, and I know you're kind of a farm boy too, you very quickly realize that what is Eastern, the geographic signature of Eastern Connecticut is these somewhat dilapidated former factory towns, these post-industrial mill towns, surrounded by tremendous amounts of open space. Some of it's farmland, a lot of it's forest. The Patchogue State Forest is big enough. It's you could almost fit three cities of Hartford inside the Patchogue State Forest. It's that big. If it were a town, it would be one of the biggest towns in the state. So you kind of do feel as though, I've always felt anyway, if UFOs are going to come anywhere in Connecticut, they're going to come to Eastern Connecticut, right? I mean, there's that funkiness, and there's sort of a sense that, you know, Connecticut doesn't have a lot of wild places, but there's wild places out there. Can you talk about them?
Oh, absolutely. I had never talked to grown adults before who spoke passionately about the UFOs that they have seen until I moved back to Eastern Connecticut. And more than one person, more than two people have told me and would probably swear on a stack of Bibles that they had really seen something really unusual in the sky at night. Also, the ghost stories you mentioned, the vampires in Griswold, you know, when you have cemeteries, old graveyards that date back to the earliest years of the country, it's probably inevitable that there are stories and legends and wives' tales that attach to them. So it really is a place where anything is possible, and there is real mystery in the ancientness of the place.
There's a great book by a young writer named Zachary Lamont, and it's called Weird Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And how interesting that it's almost all about Eastern Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, that's, if you're going to do that Connecticut Curiosities book, that you're going to start there. You're going to start in Eastern Connecticut and work west. There's other stuff in the west, but there's just a higher concentration in the east. And John Manuel Andriot, another thing about this is that you kind of can't get there from here, right? I mean, that's the old joke. But, you know, obviously for Stephen and Wally, sure, 95 goes zooming by New London. But there really are places in Eastern Connecticut that are not easily accessible. You know, that there's some little winding road that brings you there, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's something that that I actually love about Eastern Connecticut is its country charm, its New England-ness. That was one of the things that drew me back after so many years away, is that it really is a distinct place. It's not like everything else. It's not a place of strip malls and homogenization. It really is a unique place unto itself, and I find that really intriguing.
And Stephen Dobbins also, there's a class thing. There's a lot of class things. We'll probably be coming back to this a few times in the conversation, too. But, you know, if you go down the Connecticut coast, you know, Old Saybrook is one thing, right? And you go further and further east, and you get to New London, and suddenly you're in a very different place. You're still along the Connecticut shore, but you're obviously, first of all, in something resembling a city. But more than that, it's sort of suddenly not quite so waspy. It's more of a melting pot, right? Your novel is full of characters from all over the place, from Portugal. Right. And, you know, say some more about that, about what New London is that way.
Just the just that wild contrast. I mean, and what bothers me about New London is the poverty of it, and the contrast of the poverty with the money. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have the guard is a gorgeous theater, you know, a renovated, what, probably 1920s theater. But on Bank Street, there's a theater that's been closed since the early 70s, which is also sort of an old opera house. I mean, it was a vaudeville house that was built in 1922. It was where George Allen and Gracie Burns met, for instance. And those two buildings, I mean, there's a scene in my book where one of the characters, two of the characters, are wandering through that theater at night with flashlights, and then bad things happen. Not supernatural, just natural is bad enough.
Well, you're writing a novel. Bad things have to happen. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back more with more about the authorial voice of southeastern Connecticut after this.
Boy's birthday. It's just a rumor that was spread around town by the women and children. Soon we'll be shipbuilding.
Hi, neighbor. Have a Gansett. Narragansett lager beer. It has straight from the barrel taste. Straight from the barrel taste. Why you'll enjoy saying hi, neighbor. Have a Gansett, Narragansett lager beer.
We think the new Narragansett jingle is great. It'll be a big hit. I hope you agree. And don't forget to join us for Red Sox Baseball, brought to you by
Narragansett lager beer.
So, Wally Lamb, that's it in a nutshell, right? I mean, it's Narragansett beer, it's Kurt Gowdy, it's the Boston Red Sox.
Yeah, but I demand equal billing for Rheingold, actually.
Yeah. So we're talking about sort of the authorial voice of southeastern Connecticut and sort of, you know, the way, in fact, which writers have made the place come alive. And with us, Wally Lamb, his books include I Know This Much Is True, She's Come Undone. Coming up, I'll Take You There, which will be published electronically by Meta Books in 2016. John Manuel Andriot is a reporter and author, most recently of Tough Love. A Washington reporter finds resilience, ruin, and zombies in his other Connecticut hometown. Stephen Dobbins is joining us by phone. His latest novel is Fat Bob Dead Yet? And on the 7th of November in New London, he will be at the Public Library to talk about whether or not Fat Bob is dead and maybe sign the book and do some readings and stuff like that. So I want to talk a little bit about the way in which history works there in this area. So, you know, Stephen Dobbins, one thing we've haven't really talked about that much is the way in which this, like, New London's a coastal town. It's a seagoing town. It's a seafaring town. Its story is that of the sea. And it's also inevitably part of that, I think, is it's another way in which bad things happen, right? What does Benedict Arnold wind up burning? You know, I mean, he comes in. Yeah, he burns Bank Street. You know, where does John Mason slaughter the Pequots? Well, he does it in Mystic. And there's a sense, I was reading in David Hackett Fisher's book, Albion Seed, how people in that area, people who lived within 20 miles of the coast, were told up to 1775, always have your guns with you because the British could come at any time, could come by sea. And that even for decades and decades after that, the tradition persisted of men leaving the church first to make sure the redcoats weren't outside. I mean, they after a while, it was just a habit. They weren't worried about the redcoats anymore, but they did it. And that was all along the seacoast because you have a sense in a place like New London that you're exposed from that direction, right? Is that there in the psychology, do you think, of the city, or at least your fictional version of the city?
I think that's still there. You know, obviously, there are no whaling boats or no danger anymore. Maybe the submarines across the river in Groton. But it, you know, it's a town with a very complicated history and an exciting history. You know, you go over to the fort in Groton where Benedict Arnold and other Brits were fighting off the rebels. I mean, it's very striking, this place up on a hill with a obelisk and these dirt walls around it. That's always there to remind you of what that past is.
And so there are all these reminders of the past, and I'm going to have our other two guests kind of walk us through a couple more. So while, you know, you talked about Norwich Free Academy being sort of this almost kind of Greco-Roman pillar of civilization, this kind of aperture that could take you almost to any world of knowledge. But the other big looming tower for you in Norwich is the State Hospital, right?
Yeah, Norwich State Hospital was a big influence on me when I was a kid. Only from the outside, I would ride in the back of my parents' station wagon and I would be very excited if I saw somebody on the sidewalk. Oh, that must be a crazy person. So it was a kind of a combination of fascination and dread for me. And, you know, I didn't realize that when I grew up and started teaching and writing that I would sort of go back to the state hospital and investigate mental illness in many of my books.
So this was it's defunct now, we should say. There are occasionally talks of – well, John Manuel, there's just talks occasionally of turning it into a city park or something, right? Did they do that?
Well, the state hospital property was sold by the state of Connecticut to the town of Preston, where the land of the property, most of the land, is located. I think 40 or 50 acres of it are actually on the Norwich side of the town line. So there have been various plans and schemes to redevelop it. It's quite a spectacular location, directly across the Thames River from the Mohegan Sun Hotel. So the buildings have been largely leveled at this point, and for the first time in my lifetime, you can actually see across the river, and at night you can see the hotel tower at Mohegan Sun. So. Yeah, so the hospital itself is a haunted memory, but the place, the physical place, is slowly being redeveloped.
There's sort of a lot of that down there. I mean, there's also down in Waterford the Seaside Sanatorium, which is slated to become a state park. At one point, they were discussing various ways to handle this because it's also kind of a spooky place. This is a place where kids with tuberculosis were housed, and I mean, if you look at the interiors of it, it looks like Shutter Island or something, or some really scary movie. At one point, they were talking about having it be, I think they used the phrase, a controlled ruin. They were just like going to let it kind of collapse and have that be part of the coolness. I think they decided not to do that. But Wally, until I read your essay about this whole area, I hadn't realized lithium was actually developed at.
Yeah,
this was alluded to in the introduction, obviously. But
That's what I had heard from more than one person in the Ribicoff building. I had heard, and it was lithium was developed by, first of all, giving it to monkeys and mm-hmm. then to men and women. And I heard stories about how several of the therapists who lived on the on and around the hospital had monkeys for pets. They would bring the lab monkeys home, and
the mood stabilized lab monkeys.
Well, hopefully, yeah.
I don't know how you would be able to tell that a monkey's mood had been stabilized, but maybe it's more obvious than I think it is. I want to talk about one more aspect of history. So, Stuart, you mentioned Stephen, excuse me. You mentioned in your book, and I think you just said it before too about Benedict Arnold, but John Manuel Andriotte. Benedict Arnold is like a really big problem in Norwich. You know, it's like a really big thing. And I just showed you guys some pictures here in the studio. I went in the 1980s. There's a guy named William Stanley, who both Wally and you know or knew, who really felt like, well, if they can do it with witches in Salem, I mean, that's not a nice story either, you know? Mm-hmm. But if they could turn that into a tourist attraction, why can't we take America's most famous traitor and do something with this? Tell us a little bit more. I know you wrote several times about him, so tell us what you wrote about him.
Well, I actually agreed with Bill Stanley that Norwich has this strange sense of shame about Benedict Arnold, the fact that he spent his boyhood in Norwich before he moved to New Haven. So there's been this 200-plus-year-old shame and desire to sort of keep him as the city's dirty little secret. We're very proud of Samuel Huntington, the other illustrious figure from the Revolutionary War era, who was Connecticut's 18th governor, a signer of the Declaration of Independence. And, you know, I've argued that we have a hero and an anti-hero, and that we need to get past our sense of shame that Benedict Arnold was from here and realize that other people don't feel that shame, and other people would be very interested in coming and seeing where he grew up and hearing the story of his life and spending their money in our town to do that.
I'm going to tell you something right now, okay, at the risk of upsetting you. Nobody has ever heard of Samuel Huntington. I mean, nobody knows who that is. Everybody knows who Benedict Arnold is. Yeah, Wally.
I bet I'm the only one in this room, though, who has actually seen the B and the A carved into a beam at the house where he lived. When I was in high school, I was friends with a guy who lived there in that house. And he took me up into the attic and showed me the, you know, his initials carved into the one of the carrying beams.
Well, there's something. Well, first of all, let me grab a few calls here. And we also, I think somebody tweeted us or emailed us and said, "What about Willimantic?" And it is true; it's a huge oversight on our part. I don't know if there is like somebody who's intrinsically a Willimantic novelist or essayist. If so, we should have had that person on. But Willimantic is like its own thing, right? I mean, it really is. It's everything that we've just talked about in terms of downtrodden people, incredible mixings of different cultures. It's got poverty bumping up against sort of professors and affluence. And I mean, it's everything that we just talked about, but then it's its own weird thing. You know Willimantic fairly well, right?
I know it very well. I had an office there for about 20 years, and my family and I began in Willimantic. And Three Rivers, the town that I write about, is kind of a hybrid of Norwich and Willimantic. I kind of fudge it and make it both places.
We've got another New London writer calling in, Rand Cooper, a regular appearer on this show. Hi, Rand.
Hey, Colin.
What have you got for us?
Well, it's like a pitchfork to my heart not being able to be on this show as a New Londoner. But I want to recommend a novel. Maybe you guys talked about it. I missed the first part of the show. But a forgotten novel, I think written in the 70s, about New London, called The Great Sunflower by Clifford Stone. Wally, do you know that book?
I don't. No, it's new to me.
So Clifford Stone was a horticulturist and a gardener at the Harkness Estate in Waterford. And he might have been a writing fellow at Stanford or something. But sometime in the early 70s, he published this novel, rather F. Scott Fitzgerald-like, sort of evocative in a certain lyrical way of The Great Gatsby, about New London, about being a person who leaves New London and comes back. And it begins with this great train ride coming back from New York and his sense of thrill as he approaches New London. It's a coming-of-age story. It's about a friendship. It has a lot of psychological complexity, but it is centrally about a kind of romance of New London, looking back to, since New London is a city whose greatness lies behind it, looking back to the greatness of New London, and really experiencing New London as a place of a poignancy and in some regard decline. And it's a lavishly romantic book. It got a lot of great reviews. He never really did anything again. He died a number of years ago. So that's sort of one of those forgotten books, Clifford Stone, The Great Sunflower.
Mm. Well, thank you for that one. Stephen, you're the one who just did a New London novel. Did you know about that one?
I had no idea, no.
All right.
I'm going to look for it.
Yeah.
And he was a very, very popular figure around New London in the 70s and 80s, affiliated with the Hygienic, was very much part of the New London scene and doesn't deserve to be forgotten. So remember him.
All right.
There was a Norwich author a couple of decades before that, Grace Savage. She wrote a book, several books, but I think her most successful one was Parish, about the
which is like the worst movie ever.
Yeah,
but it's like the greatest worst movie ever. I mean, it really is like the greatest worst movie ever.
In the Peyton Place vein.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was about the tobacco fields. It's about the tobacco fields up in the Windsor area. We've talked about it a couple of times here, and I always get corrected about this whenever I say it, but so Carl Malden in that, who's like, he's in the movie, he's like the tobacco czar, he's
right.
Like, you know, the kingpin, and he's always sitting in his office, and it's like his office almost has to be in Bushnell Park the way the Capitol is. You can see the state capitol. It's like, wow, his office is in Bushnell Park. Somebody always emails me and goes, no, you can tell actually where the office is, and it's not. But anyway, yeah, it's terrible, but it's... I love that movie. All right, Jeannie from Waterbury. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
What's that? Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment on one of your guests about the highway doesn't go very far.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody told me Connecticut was the ugliest state she had ever been to. And I said, that's because we don't put highways where we don't want you.
That could actually be like a little sign as you're entering the state. And this highway doesn't go where we don't want you.
Yeah,
but welcome to Connecticut anyway.
And that's a real Eastern Connecticut attitude.
That's right. Yeah. Get out of here. Don't bother us. This is Gill's Ferry. Leave us alone. All right. We're going to take a quick break. What we haven't really talked about, of course, the big X factor. I mean, it's been alluded to a few times. But the casinos. In the middle of all this stuff, we drop the casinos.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Our interns are Dan Schultz and Sarah Flaherty. The part of Bill Curry was played by Eugene O'Neill. For show pages, articles, and oh no, pictures of us waving goodbye, goodbye sadly to the Faith Middleton Show staff, visit our website, WNPR.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, a publication that takes you to the wildest places, both far and away, in your own backyard. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, so the news is probably out now. The Faith Middleton Show staff will no longer, the Faith Middleton Show will no longer be five times a week. This is the show that kind of invented talk radio here in Connecticut. We won't be. So tomorrow you're going to hear a rebroadcast of our show about Atlas Obscura, and I'm sure there'll be some affectionate joke about the Faith Middleton Show staff, but there won't be any new ones anymore. So I'm going to be off for a couple of days. We loved our Atlas Obscura show. It's about going to wonderful places or about kind of it fits with today, too, because one thing that this incredible travel site does is write about things that are in your backyard, things that I'm sure they've got a Norwich entry, something, one of the things that we talked about. Please do enjoy that tomorrow. We're talking about the authorial literary voice of southeastern Connecticut. We're talking to Stephen Dobbins. His book is Fat Bob Dead Yet? We're also talking to John Manuel Andriotte. His book is Tough Love, a series of his columns and essays about the greater Norwich area. And Wally Lamb, his next novel, I'll Take You There, will be published electronically by Meta Books in 2016. Is Wishing and Hoping, do we have like a schedule for when we're going to get to see more of Wishing and Hoping?
Yeah. In fact, they're going to run the movie at the Guard again in November.
Oh, cool.
It's a Lifetime movie, so I'm sure it'll recirculate on that channel. I was a little disappointed, though, when the ratings came in, when the movie premiered on Lifetime and we were beaten in those ratings by Sex Sent Me to the ER.
Well... titles are important. You know, if you were up against Is Fat Bob Dead Yet, you might have had problems too. Titles can do that to you. Check your local listings, because if you missed it last time around, it's going to be like, you know, all those like all the other sort of A Wonderful Life and stuff. It's going to be like one of these classic holiday things. You watch it every year. All right. So we haven't talked about the X Factor, which is the two casinos. So you have this area that's sort of really maybe a little bit more stalled in its own older history than a lot of places would be. The Revolutionary War, John Trumbull and the office in Lebanon and things like that, and the burning of New London. And these things are pretty fresh, you know, in the history of southeastern Connecticut and that sense of what the Native Americans were a long time ago. But they weren't around that much. Suddenly, and Wally, this is sort of something that you said, growing up in Norwich, in the 50s and 60s, you really think of yourself as you weren't really from Indian country, right?
No, nor did I know that a lot of my fellow students had Native American blood. It just never came up. In fact, it might have been a little bit hidden. And then the irony is that, you know, the Cold War kind of fizzles out and electric boat starts, laying off, you know, thousands and just as the area is really on the ropes economically, along come, you know, the Native Americans rise from the ashes and build these casinos that really economically save the area.
So Stephen Dobbins, they're there in your fiction too, but one senses that you're not a huge fan of these casinos.
They prey on the vulnerable, and if you look at the crime rates within a 50-mile radius of a casino, you know, robberies are up, alcoholic driving and crashes are up. There are more divorces. There are more all kinds of things just from the effect of the casino.
Although from the point of a novelist, of course, you want, once again, you want places where things happen, and casinos are great for that. Things are happening all the time there.
Well, I had a friend that worked there, and his job was to be in a little room with about four or five other husky guys. And when anything happened, they would be out there in a moment, you know, stopping a person who was fighting, or if there was a suicide, they'd clean up the blood, and everything would be cleaned up, and you know, the games would be playing again in 10 minutes. And that's what they do. They just waited for somebody's bad luck to happen.
Yeah.
And then they were like rockets. They just shot in there and fixed it.
I had somehow or other forgotten about this, but so years ago I was writing this serialized novel, which I think you were following for a while, mm-hmm. Wally. And so the Foxwoods had just kind of opened not too long before that. And I'd never been to Foxwoods, but I thought, well, I'm crazy if I don't. Because as a writer, you kind of want to set something in a casino, right? You've got it all of a sudden. And I went down there, and I remember several things really surprised me. One of them was I wanted there to be a scene where people had to steal something that was in a casino. And so I was being walked around by Mickey Brown, who was the guy who was running the casino at the time. And I said, so I thought maybe it could happen at Christmas or something when there's nobody here. He goes, are you kidding me? He goes, Christmas is like one of our most busy days of the year. And I thought, really? That's so horrible and disturbing to me. And the other thing was, like, you meet these gamblers, you know, who they have all these systems and they have, you know. I met one guy who was like a air conditioning contractor who – what he did is he'd show up with I think it was like $100 in three of his pockets. And so when one pocket got empty, he'd go and have a couple of drinks and calm down. And then the other pocket would empty, he'd have a couple of drinks. And then if he lost the 100 that was in the third pocket, it was time to go home. That was his system. It was like that was his sort of off switch, like how he knew when to stop. John Manuel, obviously this is something as a journalist you just have to write about all the time. And as this was being debated in the late 80s and early 90s, I mean, there was this sort of question, what's it going to do to the indigenous character of this region? What, you know, is will these towns be recognizable by the time this is done? Is it going to look like Atlantic City? Is it going to look like Vegas? I mean, I think we know that didn't happen. But as somebody who looked at this at a pretty finely grained level, what do you think did happen?
Well, yeah, I mean, since I moved back to Norwich, I have written about the casinos and the impact on the region because it hasn't all been sweetness and light, unfortunately. The casinos brought thousands of jobs, yes, but they brought low-paying jobs for people with not a lot of skills. And so after the folks who formerly worked at Electric Boat, who were unionized skilled laborers, when they were laid off by the thousands, tens of thousands in the early 90s, many of them applied for jobs at the casinos making substantially less money. And I've written about the impact of that on what I describe as people's dignity. I think that's something that I've really seen change dramatically in Norwich in the 40 years since I was in high school at Norwich Free Academy, is that back then, someone who was a pipe fitter at Electric Boat could afford a nice little house and a camper and a vacation, possibly even a stay-at-home wife. And that is a certain kind of lifestyle, a certain sense of oneself and one's place in the world. And what I see now in Norwich instead is tremendous poverty, where 50% of the city's population is classified as working poor. And I see around me a city that has lost a sense of dignity. And I attribute that to the impact of the casinos, a very negative impact.
But there's a more positive aspect of that. And I see it at the Norwich Free Academy because there are something like 16, 17 native languages being spoken there. And so there's this infusion of multiculturalism and multicultural kids, which I think is very healthy for the, for the region. And, hopefully with assimilation, some of these people with crappy jobs can, you know, in the next generation can, as my own immigrant grandparents, you know, they were Italians who came over in the, the very first years of the 20th century. And it's sort of that kind of history repeating itself in Norwich.
Well, I mean, and that gets to – I've got a call from Judy I want to get to. So, Judy, hang in there. But, I mean, this is a point also that it's a complicated one to make because, okay, so there's an image of Connecticut, right? And that image was sort of driven by Bing Crosby movies and by the sheer existence of Katharine Hepburn and by Samuel Huntington, for all I know, of that this is sort of basically a Protestant enclave, right? You know, Christmas in Connecticut. This is – and that what maybe Litchfield is or was – was 50 years ago, was kind of an American image for what Connecticut was. And it's never really been true anywhere. But I do feel as though in Eastern Connecticut, and the writing you guys do, all of you, I mean, Wally, your characters are, well, first of all, they're not Protestant. They're almost all Catholic, right?
And half of them are Italian. Yeah. And I like Chinese food.
and the same with you, Stephen, right? I mean, this is if somebody is still clinging to the Katharine Hepburn idea of Connecticut, which is located just a, you know, about 25 miles down the road in Fenwick and Old Saybrook, I mean, this is a different Connecticut.
That's certainly right. You might find a trace of it in Stonington. And Mystic is certainly a thriving town with one of the best bookstores I've ever seen. But mm-hmm. mostly, you're right, it's poor, and you're not going to find Katharine Hepburn here. Right. You're not even going to find her poster.
Right. Good bookstores in either direction, R.G. Julia in Madison and then Bank Street Books in Mystic. All right, Judy from Cheshire, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi there, Colin. Enjoy your show. I'm a member. But I'm just listening and wondering, we were talking about the State Hospital, which is no longer there, and the casinos, but what about the U.S. Woodford Academy in London, which is an awesome, great, reputed, you know, academy, college, and also the new Coast Guard, United States Coast Guard Academy, which is going to be located there in New London at the train station for which the ground has already been broken. It's
a great point. And actually, I think the Coast Guard, I was in the movie theater the other day, and there was a trailer for like a Coast Guard, a really exciting, spine-tingling looking Coast Guard movie. So I feel like the Coast Guard is going to get sexy all of a sudden. So that's a point worth making. And Stephen, the point that she's making really does tie into what we were talking about before, too. This is the overarching culture of New London, anyway, is a maritime culture.
Right. I mean, it's not an area that has surrendered. There's still attempts to do something to make it better. I mean, that's constantly happening. But it can be a sad place with unemployment and people walking the streets, who have no jobs, no place to go.
Yeah, there's a great character in your book. Fidget is very down and out person who is not only a homeless alcoholic, but because of some kind of delirium, he actually thinks he has a tail. Kind of maybe symbolic of that problem. So John Manuel Andreot, I just wanted just the one thing that we didn't really touch on, and we've only got a minute or two left here, but I mean, your book begins with your decision to come back to this place. I mean, you really didn't need to come back to Norwich, mm-hmm. not necessarily. You'd gone through some major changes in your life. You'd been diagnosed HIV positive, but there was something calling you back, some kind of resolution you wanted to have. Could you say something about that? Why go back to this place, which compared to the other places you'd lived is a little bit of a backwater. Sorry, yeah, Norwich.
No, you're right. And people in Norwich have asked me that. They've said, you know, most people want to leave here and not come back. And that's true. But I felt something deeper in me calling me back, I think. And when I look back on the 8 years now that I've lived back in Norwich, you know, it's been financially a struggle. There aren't a lot of opportunities for someone with my very good Washington, D.C. resume. Mm-hmm. But I've never regretted the decision to move back there. I've never said this was a mistake because I see myself connecting with sort of deeper parts of myself. You know, what does it mean to be a New Englander? What does it mean to have that heritage of strong Yankee resilience? I'm working on a new book now about building resilience in gay men. And, I am reading Thoreau and connecting with all this stuff that New England is about, self-reliance and independence, and realizing those things are really powerful forces in making me who I am.
We're going to have to stop there, but yeah. Thank you, Wally Lamb. Thank you, John Manuel Andreot. Thank you, Stephen Dobbins. Go see Stephen Dobbins at the Public Library in New London on Saturday, November 7th at 1. And thanks to Betsy Kaplan.
I've searched it with a fine-tooth comb and found that I only have one home, sweet home. Connecticut always will be my home.
In the name of General Washington, who goes there?
It is I, Thaddeus Wexford of Groton.
How do we know you're not a British spy?
I promise you I'm not.
How do you pronounce this river?
THAMES.
Thames.
Grab 'em, boys.
Come on, let's get it.